At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust. In this week's episode, I speak to Richard Palmer, who is the founder of the Eating Disorder Recovery Clinic and an eating disorder therapist. We speak all about the role of an eating disorder therapist, the difficulty in accessing the right treatment, and the different therapies that a patient may need. We speak about the training that is required to be an eating disorder therapist and how working within eating disorders can be draining and burnout can happen, but the reason why people do it and why it is so rewarding. We also speak about the resilience and the characteristics that are needed of therapists. And I really hope that any therapist listening to this feels so proud to do the work that they do. And I'm really grateful to you because it is not an easy job, but you are doing amazing work. And I hope that this podcast reflects that. So we today, very excitingly, are talking about your clinic, the Eating Disorder Recovery Clinic. And I'm actually very excited for both you and I that we're having this conversation because I shared something on Instagram the other day that was from your Instagram feed. And I had several people contact me and say, oh, are you having these guys on your podcast? And really excited to hear about your service. So for those people that were very excited, what is the Eating Disorder Recovery Clinic and who are you?
Well, I'm glad you asked. The Eating Disorder Recovery Clinic is the... where do I even start? It's so hard to put something that's so big and meaningful into just a few words. Yeah. Can I start with who I am?
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And take it
That's
from
the most
there.
Important thing. That's who we're talking to.
Yeah. So I'm a therapist by trade. So I trained and qualified as a therapist back in 20... I started to train in 2011 and qualified in 2015. I have a lot of personal experience with eating disorders. So people close to me. I've never been diagnosed with an eating disorder, but I recognise in myself that I would have ticked the boxes for binge eating disorder at various points in my life. And I've had friends with eating disorders. So eating disorders have always been very prominent for me and very important for me. But during our training, we were always advised against working with clients with eating disorders. You know, there's something that's almost a little bit taboo about it. You know, it's one of those things that seems as being a bit too hard or too complex for us to work with. Yeah, so it's really common therapy trainings that I'm aware of being discouraged. But, you know, working with eating disorders is almost a taboo in the therapy world, unless you're in the NHS or in one of the big organisations. And that's primarily because they are very complex. And of course, far too many people do die from them, whether that's from medical complications or through suicide. They are high risk illnesses. So I had this massive personal passion to work with eating disorders, but I didn't have that professional framework to work with eating disorders. because there's very little training in it in the psychotherapy world. Fast forward sort of 5 years. So I worked as a generalist therapist for the first 5 years of my qualified career. And the Iron Mill College, which is a college that specialises in psychotherapy training down in Devon, near where I am in Somerset, they launched a six-month eating disorder diploma. So I saw this diploma and thought, you know what, I'm going to give this a go because I don't understand why we can't do it. Now, as this was launching, I actually had two clients with eating disorders. Now, the clients weren't working with me for the eating disorder. I had to refer them to the NHS for that. We were working more on the underlying stuff, the underlying traumas and the anxieties. But the clients were coming back to sessions with me saying, actually, the help I'm getting elsewhere isn't really helping with the eating disorder. I don't feel that I'm getting the best that I could be from this. So a combination of that and my personal interests made me go, oh, you know, let's take a risk and do this diploma. Brilliant move, fantastic move, because it was one of the most enjoyable trainings I have ever done in my life. The tutor was amazing. The group was amazing. It was fantastic. And the tutor, a lady, no relation to myself, but called Sarah Palmer. The very first week, she was telling us about herself and how she got into working with eating disorders, because during her training, her initial training was also, it was different to my initial training. She was told, oh, you know, we shouldn't really work with eating disorder clients. It's too big, it's too complex, it's too dangerous. And with her history of eating disorders and you know, being around people with eating disorders, she sat there and said, why? Why can't we do this? So she did. And that built up and up, and she worked for a couple of organizations, and then she was doing this training. But it was her saying, actually, no, we can do this. We can support these clients, that made me really want to get involved in that as much as I could, because that's my, you know, eating disorders. They're horrible. They're devastating. They are awful for the people with them and the people around them. For me to work with, that makes them so interesting and so rewarding to work with. So back in 2020, coming off the end of this diploma, I went full hog into, I'm just going to work with eating disorders. I don't care what the people around me say. I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it work. And that's what I did. I've spent the next 3 years just myself, an independent practitioner, as most therapists in the UK are, working by myself, figuring out how to work with eating disorders. And I loved it. You know, and I love every single minute of it. It's amazing work. But there's a downside. And the downside is being an independent therapist is actually really quite lonely. Because of the nature of our work, we can't talk to many people. I can't go home and talk about my day at work. I can't go out for a drink with friends and talk about my clients. You know, for obvious reasons, that would be highly frowned upon. And so it gets quite lonely quite quickly. And then with eating disorders, that's almost compounded, because even though we have to have clinical supervision, and even though most of us have colleagues who are therapists, very few of them have any experience with eating disorders. So even if you spoke to them about it, there's no real support there. There's no back and forth there. I had, because of my experiences on diploma, I had a few therapists who work for my other business. So my other business is another therapy business, and we take trainee therapists and they do their clinical placement with us. So because of my experience was on the eating disorder diploma, they decided to go and do the eating disorder diploma. But for various reasons, they didn't want to set up their own private practice working with eating disorder clients. So we get to this point in sort of very early this year, early 2023, where I'm loving what I do. but emotionally finding it very challenging because it's such deep work. So finding it very, very emotionally challenging. And constantly turning clients away, because by now my name's getting out there a bit. I was starting with an average of one new client a month, and I was getting an average of 14, 15 inquiries a month. So 13, 14 people a month I was having to turn away, saying, I mean, sorry, but I'm fully booked. And they're asking, okay, can you recommend anyone? No, I can't. So, you know, there's a few people near London I know. There's a couple of organisations I know, but no one in this area. And then my health caught up with me, and I ended up having an operation on my back. So I took, it was going to be up to 3 months off work. In the end, it was, I think, 2 months I had off work. I have ADHD. Being off work and having to lay very, very still while my back recovers from an operation was not healthy for my brain. So I dived headfirst into setting up an organization so that the colleagues I had who had done the training but didn't want to do private practice could come and join me and work alongside me in an organization, small organization. I made this a long story, but cutting the story short, we end up in April when I'm about to come back to work, or March I'm about to come back to work. And I contact the two of the therapists. I say, look, this is what I'm doing. Do you want to join me? If you want to join me, we launch on the 1st of April. So they both said yes. And 1st of April 2023, we launched the Eating Disorder Recovery Clinic in Somerset. That's a brief, not very brief, overview of me. I'm a great waffler, and I'm a great waffler.
It's good for a podcast.
So that's about me. I need it. Can you guide me with a question?
Yeah. So I was going to say, I thought you were going to go somewhere then, but I was going to say, I have quite a few questions based on what you've said. Mm. And firstly, I think it's fantastic that you have started the clinic, because as you very clearly documented in what you've just said, there are so many people that need help. And so many people that aren't getting the right kind of help. And I have a question in terms of, so you were saying that you had a lot of patients that were coming to you when you weren't specializing in eating disorders, and you were kind of going to the trauma and the stuff kind of below the eating disorder. Yeah. And then they were going to the NHS for eating disorder support, and it wasn't really working.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still the approach that you have with your clients now in terms of supporting them with eating disorder recovery, or is there like a different method that you use, or are there things that you like add on now that you are working with eating disorders, or people with eating disorders, sorry?
That's a really good question. It's been a very steep learning curve over the last sort of 3 years, learning how to work with eating disorders. You know, there's various approaches out there. There's various textbooks therapists can buy. There's various very short training courses therapists can go on to learn how to work with eating disorders. But if you dive into the evidence on those, at best, you're looking at around 33-34% recovery rates, at best. You know, they're not fantastic. And one of the reasons that I would argue they're not fantastic is because those approaches, there's nothing really inherently wrong in those approaches as they are. It's just that they don't work on the underlying stuff. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, like, CBT for eating disorders. I'm a bit of a fan of it. I've done the training in it. I've done clinical placement in it. I use it a lot in my work. When a client comes to me and says, can I have CBT for my eating disorder? And I only want CBT for my eating disorder. I will turn around and say, no, you can have that elsewhere, but I will not provide that. And the reason I won't provide it is because, you know, in the textbook for it and all the training for it, it's actually states in CBTE, we do not work on the underlying causes for an eating disorder. I view, yeah, I know this next bit is a bit that's hotly debated, and quite rightly, because we don't know. I view eating disorders primarily as coping mechanisms. You know, primarily our brains are trying to keep us safe from something. You know, whether that's our emotions, our thoughts, trauma, you know, whatever it is, our brain's trying to keep us safe. And so for me, there's no point working on just the eating disorder and ignoring the underlying stuff, because their brains are going to go, well, we can't cope. You know, we need something else to help us cope. And there's also no point just working on the underlying stuff without addressing the eating disorder, because most people are ill for so long and become such a strong, powerful habit. And because there's benefits there, it's very hard to let go of it. It's very hard to move away from the eating disorder. So you have to, in my view, you have to combine both approaches in one.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
So what I've been doing myself and now trying to do with this clinic is integrating the best parts of CBTE and mantra and IFS, so internal family systems, and a few other therapies, like cognitive remediation therapy, integrating those with the underlying work. So I describe that as being sort of more traditional therapy. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we do sort of a 4 or 5 week assessment with new clients who are coming in. And at the end of that assessment, we'll have a great big long list of some eating sort of things that need addressing, some trauma things that need addressing, anxiety, depression, family, work, education, whatever it is. We have a great big long list. And we agree a rough order that we're going to address those problems with, or problems in. And as we're working through them, we're constantly checking in. How are you? How are you doing with your mood, with anxiety, with your thoughts? And as they're starting to improve, as the person's starting to improve in how they're feeling, we can go, oh, okay, does this mean we can now increase the quantity of your food? Or can we increase the variety of your food? Or if someone's come to us with binge eating disorder, it would be, oh, can we try and eat more regularly to reduce the risk of binging? So we do it in quite a stepped approach. It will be work with an underlying thing, then work with eating disorder, underlying thing, eating disorder, underlying thing, eating disorder. And I found generally that's the most productive way forward, most effective way forward for us. Doesn't work for everything, everyone, because nothing ever will.
Yeah.
Generally, it's working pretty well for us.
Yeah. It's really refreshing hearing what you're saying. I think it's hopefully becoming more sort of common knowledge. But I think you're completely right in the fact that you can't just do one thing. You can't just do the eating disorder symptoms, or you can't just do the trauma, or you can't just do the underlying issues. And with that comes the whole, you can't just do the one form of therapy. And it's actually really interesting what you were saying when you started talking about how, you know, eating disorders are a coping mechanism. And I was like, yeah, I do agree. But I think they start out as a coping mechanism. And then you went on to say about how, you know, it actually, because they can persist for so long, it becomes habitual. It becomes somebody's just automatic response. And through my own personal experience, that is literally like the place where I'm in at the moment, in that I'm realizing that these coping mechanisms I've been using for 10 or so years, it took me a long time to realize it, they're not actually that good. You know, from a mixture of like personal things happening outside of the eating disorder, I think I've been actually in a weird way quite lucky in my life, in that the biggest thing to impact me is the eating disorder, which I know sounds really weird, but I've almost, because that's just kind of been always the perpetual thing, that's all I've sort of had to deal with. And I guess that is part of an eating disorder, is that you because you have the eating disorder, you don't really think about other things. You don't think about other social concepts that are happening or like things that are happening outside of your world because you're so focused on the eating disorder. And then recently there's been things that have happened that I can't avoid and I've had to deal with. And so my capacity to deal with things has just completely exploded. And that's been the realization for me, in that this eating disorder is not actually helping, but it is so habitual that the frustration is now building that I can't break out of it, but I need to be able to break out of it. And it's a very interesting sort of journey that I'm finding myself on, because I'm realizing this isn't helping. This has never been helping. But now that stuckness is so strong that you can't just kind of like snap out of it as I wish I would. And I think that's why what you were saying about, you know, the different approaches is so important. Mm-hmm. Because one form of therapy for that would not just, that's not just going to kind of, I'm not just going to be able to do that and then all of a sudden the light switch goes and off we go. But
absolutely.
Oh no, what were you going to say something?
I was going to say absolutely. And that's why the research does tend to show that for all the benefits of things like CBTE and mantra and the other approaches, at best a 33-34% effective one delivered just as that approach, because they're not dealing with everything else that's going on.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is where my next question was going to come, and this may be a very difficult question to answer, but I know that we spoke about this when we had a little chat beforehand, in that I think we're starting to realise we're talking about it right now, the fact that one singular form of treatment doesn't help somebody. You know, you can't just have therapy. You might need to see a dietitian, you might need to work with a nurse, that sort of thing. You need that integrated approach, which when you have services like the recovery clinic, and obviously that's what we're talking about today, so I really do want to kind of focus on that, that's brilliant. But the issue comes in that most people only have access to services such as the NHS, and the NHS doesn't have the resources, the funding, the structure to be able to provide people this approach that we're now realizing works. So what happens then?
That's a very good question, and you're right, that's a very hard one to answer.
I don't know, your screen went back.
It did go back, didn't it? I don't know why. Then it came back very quickly. My headphones went weird. I'll carry on answering the question. it's something that one is actually debated really frequently between professionals, and people like myself who are working independently, we debate and discuss and look at possible options. You know, when we're talking about the NHS, I know I said this to you before when we had our chat on the phone, I have a love-hate relationship with the NHS, and that's no secret. Do I believe that the vast majority of individuals in the NHS want to do a good job and want to support the people in their care? Absolutely. You don't get a job in the NHS because you don't like people or you don't care. But the systems and the lack of financing and the lack of appropriate training just means that the vast majority of people are accessing services and they're not receiving, basically what they need, they're not receiving that integrated service. And at any one point, I will have a handful of clients who are working with both myself and various NHS's across, NHS teams across the country. And some are doing better than others at integrating treatment. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we move forward in a way that meets the needs of, you know, at least 1.25 million people with an eating disorder in the UK? Which is, that in itself, reaching 1.25 million people.
Yeah.
That's a Herculean task. And how do we integrate treatment so everyone can access the treatment that they need when they need it? And how do we make that either free at the point of access or affordable, I don't have an answer for you there, because it's so complex, it's so big. You know, I'm thinking, as I'm talking, I'm thinking to some of my clients, and some of my clients, you know, they could have 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months of integrated treatment in a service, whether it's NHS or somewhere else. Mm. And that would be enough for them, because they're only 6 months into their eating disorder, and the underlying stuff, yes, it's there, it's complex, it's big, it's heavy, but we know how to deal with it, so we can deal with it. But then there's other clients we've got who, you know, they're going to need years of support to process the sheer amount of trauma they've had, or how deeply embedded the depression is, and, you know, whatever's going on for them. I don't know. I don't know how we, you know, as a country, I don't know how we address that. Because to get the specialists, you know, we have to have that training. The training I did, the one at IML College, only runs once a year. And I think their places are capped at 18, I think. When I did it, there was only six of us on it. But then it's not just the eating disorder training. You have to have the trauma training and the depression training and the anxiety training and the self-esteem training. And so to get all that training and being able to deliver it to a client in the right way, at the right time, alongside holidays and sickness and bank holidays and Christmases, and I do not envy the people in the NHS, but also the large organisations, you know, like Sherwin Clinic or the Priory Hospital. I do not envy those people whose job it is to try and organise all of this, because. Yeah, we have 27 clients maximum at the moment. You know, it's a very small clinic. I'm keeping it small on purpose. And trying to organise this for 27 clients is a headache, because you're trying to deliver your utter best to them all the time whilst people are on holiday or whilst there's sickness. Or, yeah, we had the client cancel yesterday because there's a road closure and they could not get to us.
Yeah.
Well, that's put their treatment back a week.
It's really hard, isn't it? And I think, like, you've highlighted so many things there that mean that the eating disorder treatment is so difficult. And it just made me think about something that you were saying at the start that I wanted to ask about, in that you said that you were sort of discouraged in a way of not doing the eating disorder training. And to me, that would be kind of a great opportunity. You know, you're coming along with these very budding, exciting clinical psychologists. You know, they're ready to learn. They're very open to, like, you know, doing lots of different placements. That for me would be a great time to have lots of placements available for people to try eating disorders. Obviously, you have the difficulty that we have a mental health crisis, not just an eating disorder crisis. Yep. Therefore, we need support everywhere. But even if I think back, I'm, you know, I didn't do my clinical psychology training, but I did a master's in eating disorders. And I remember I never wanted to go down the psychology route, but I wanted to get a job working in an environment with eating disorder patients, because that's where I thought I wanted my career to go down. And it was like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Like, the job opportunities were so difficult, so competitive. And the competitiveness of it made me think, you know, there are so many individuals that want to do this, you know, like the assistant, assistant psychology roles in eating disorder clinics. That's what I wanted to do, to then go on to research, but I couldn't get one because they were so competitive. Yeah. So it makes me think, you know, starting from that base level of when people are doing their training, is it that we don't have the resources again and the capacity to provide that training? Is it that we're so sparse on therapists in eating disorders that they've not got the time and resources to provide the training to assistant psychologists? I don't know whether you have any thoughts around that.
I can certainly talk about how it'd be here to have a trainee here, because we actually have a trainee coming on board with the team next month in November. So, complete disclosure, so I didn't go down the psychology route at all. I decided very early on that route wasn't for me. So I went down the psychotherapy route. But we have the exact same problems. Getting that experience is nigh on impossible. So eating disorders, they are very, for lack of a better word, popular choice for people to want to work in. I think there's something, eating disorders are so common. Most people know of at least one person who has suffered with an eating disorder during their life. And so they become very personal to us, and we want to help people because we've seen how horrible they are. When you're in an organization or you're running an organization like this, we have so many factors to consider. And one of them is, client safety. And one of the things with client safety is we do not want to be chopping and changing therapists. Because even if the new incoming therapist knows exactly what you've covered before, it's still going to be a new relationship, new therapeutic relationship, a slightly different approach. It basically restarts the whole therapy process. So when we have trainees coming on board to do any form of therapy with clients, I would be looking for someone who's going to be able to give at least a year's time to us, if not longer. So that's really challenging. The second one, and I can't talk about this in the NHS because I know it is very different requirements, but the second one for us is insurance. We have to be insured for everything that we do, and getting insurance to cover someone who isn't at that point qualified to work with eating disorders because of the risk of death and risk of medical complications is really, really hard. So I've got, I mentioned I've got a trainee coming on board in November. I called her a trainee. She, by that point, will be a qualified therapist. She's coming on board to work in eating disorders because she thinks it's where she wants to be, and she needs to get that experience to see if it is really where she wants to be. We were only able to get insurance to cover her because she is enrolled on that eating disorder diploma and starts that diploma in 2 weeks, 2 weeks tomorrow. So by the time she starts with us, she will be on the training. And that meant we could get that insurance to cover her work. The next really challenging part for an organization is, getting the clients to see a trainee. Clients are, in our organization, clients are coming to us paying a not inconsiderable amount of money. And we're as far as treatment for eating disorders go, we're not expensive in comparison to others. But actually, for the vast majority of the population, we're a considered expense. We're talking sort of £300 a month therapy fees to work with us. So it's not cheap. It's not affordable for a lot of people. So if you've got someone coming into our service who is investing on the very basic levels their time and money, but on a much deeper level, their hope for recovery and their hope for getting that recovered life that they really desperately want and need, how many of us would want to entrust that to a trainee? Because I wouldn't. If it was me, I wouldn't. If it was my partner, I wouldn't. If it was my son, my daughter, no. I would want the qualified, experienced professional. So that's a huge problem for us. Thankfully, for this trainee, how we've got around that is, so this trainee was working in my other business as on the clinical placement. And one of her clients there disclosed having an eating disorder after they'd built up the safety of that relationship. So both the client and the trainee are coming over to this organization together and the client is very happy to work with this person, even though they're not yet qualified in eating disorders. But without that, I wouldn't take her on. She's a brilliant therapist. I've known her for over a year now. Brilliant therapist. But I wouldn't be able to take her on. So I agree with you. Yes, we've got to, you know, we've got to get the trainees in there to get that workforce coming through. But it's so hard to do.
That's such an interesting sort of thing that I've never really, yeah, I've never considered that before. Like, I'm just thinking about all the healthcare professionals, you know, like when you go to the dentist, there'll be a trainee dentist there. But, you know, personally, some people might be, but I'm not bothered about a trainee dentist watching the dentist, you know, fiddle around in my mouth. Or when you go to the GP, I'm not bothered about, depending on the subject, I'm okay for the trainee GP to be in there. But like you've said, when it comes to our mental health, I think it's specifically in eating disorders, I'm talking on eating disorders because that's what I know, but it takes so long to build that relationship with a therapist, that trust. You know, you are, I always think with an eating disorder, it must be one of the most difficult things to treat, because at the end of the day, you are having treatment for something that you feel is the one thing that protects you the most and the one thing that you do not want to let go of. And I've always said this when I've done eating sort of training with healthcare practitioners, is realistically, you've probably worked with so many people that are really grateful within that moment of, oh, thank you so much for your help today. Somebody with an eating disorder, if you're like supporting them with a meal, probably not going to be grateful, because that's probably the last thing that they want to be doing. And so having, sorry, I've gone a bit off piece there, but building that trust with somebody takes so long, and opening up to somebody, you're not just going to say, oh yeah, like, of course your trainee can come and sit in my therapy session. Somebody might say that, but then I would question how sort of open and how authentic they're going to, the client would then be in that session, because I think you would naturally hold things back. So when you're doing the training process, how does that even actually work? Because do you have to like watch videos of how therapists have worked? Because I can't imagine that people let you sit in.
Well, exactly. That's when you were saying that, I was in my head, I was thinking, no, they wouldn't be allowed to sit in on a live session with a live client. So it's really difficult to train for it. It kind of depends on where you go for the training, but we actually practice on each other. So we do what's called triad work or Gilmore groups, where you'll have one therapist, one client, and one or two observers. And you're not role-playing, some sort of, you're not given a script, but you're role-playing your role within that relationship. So I would role-play being a client. And you make it as real as possible, but it's a short 15-minute, 20-minute section with no before, no after. You know, it's not realistic at all. And so this is one of the things that you said to me you really wanted to talk about, was the role of trainees in the clinic and why that's important to me. This is why it's important to me, because you can give someone all the academic training you want, but you can't teach them how to be good with the client until they get in there with the client and learn how to do it. And that's really, really hard. And now, one thing I've seen in my other organization, the clinical placement provider organization, is, you know, to get to that point of having clinical placement, someone has done 2 or 3 years of academic training with no client work. Then, you know, they're not allowed to go anywhere near a client until they've got to their fitness to practice sign off, which happens in either the last year of their training or the year before last year. And then they come to us for clinical placement. I cannot tell you how often someone does their first session or their 10th session or their 50th session, and they come out and they go, this isn't for me. I can't do this. Yeah, they love the idea of it, but the reality is very different. And that's on things like mild to moderate depression, anxiety, which are challenging to work with, but nowhere near as challenging as an eating disorder. So the question of how do we get more trainees in and trained not only academically, but also with the clients is a massive question that we're looking at. One idea I have kind of got floating around for the clinic for the future, you know, as you know, we're a very new business. So right now is about just getting us up and running fully. But I want to, you know, 2 years down the line, 3 years down the line, set up a non-profit side of it where we can take those trainees who are on like the eating disorder diploma or on another eating disorder training, and then clients can come and have it. It couldn't be free because there's going to be overheads involved, but they could have vastly more affordable therapy with someone that they know is a trainee. But importantly, because it's connected to the recovery clinic, yes, they're a trainee, but they're surrounded by the other professionals here who have the years of experience. So we can do that hand-holding.
And also you can provide the support for them, because I think one thing I've recognised in people that are training in eating disorders and all the kind of, you know, therapists or any healthcare professional that I've met that works in eating disorders, it's a very emotionally taxing job because it's, you know, I think any mental health condition is really difficult to work with, but there's just something about eating disorders that makes it so emotionally draining. And I know when I was working in eating disorders myself, the constant talk about food, body image and exercise, that was all I would talk about all day. For somebody that had lived experience of an eating disorder, that was hard. But I remember speaking to my colleagues that hadn't got lived experience of an eating disorder and like, this is really difficult. And then not having, you know, if you're working individually, not having somebody to then offload that on, I can imagine. You know, I think one thing that's very common, like you were saying, is a lot of people will reach the point where they say, actually, this isn't for me. And I often think, I don't think that's because of the topic or sort of the clientele, but it's the emotional impact it's having. Mm-hmm. And I think that's often because you don't have that space to share what you've spoken about, to sort of talk through that, which is why you creating your sort of trainee platform for people I think would be incredible, because they, you know, obviously not disclosing names or anything, but they would have that space to share how they're feeling about what they've experienced in a therapy session, and speak to people that have been doing it for years and, you know, say, this is what I've experienced. Have you had a similar situation? Like, how did you navigate this? How did you look after yourself in this? And all of those things, which I think that is a big thing for me that is lacking within the NHS services, not only the kind of treatment that we're providing, but the support for staff as well, which is why we're seeing so many people think, I can't do this. And that's why we've just not got the appointments that we need to be able to provide.
I agree that the burnout rate is huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I, you know, it's not limited to eating disorders, as we've said, but eating disorders or complex trauma services like that, that burnout rate goes up massively. Mm. One of the things that we already do here and that would be expanded, you know, as our team grows, is every Monday we have a 2-hour meeting on a Monday. And some of that, about half an hour of that, is sort of business stuff. So that's discussing new clients coming in, clients who are being discharged, and any business stuff that needs to be gone over. But in the next hour and a half is just that offloading space or that discussing space of, oh, I've got this happening with a client, or I've got that happening with a client. So we can just support each other and try to avoid that overwhelm and that burnout.
Sure.
Because it is emotionally taxing work. And you know, you said talking about food and body image and exercise all the time takes its toll. Absolutely does. Here, because we're also working on the underlying stuff, we're also talking about complex trauma and depression and anxiety all the time, and they take their toll as well. So the resilience that is needed to work in eating disorders and mental health is massive. But that makes that care, both self-care but also care within the organization, not just important, but absolutely vital. Because if we didn't have that, so if I didn't have that, you know, with the guys we've got working here already, they'd burn out. Yeah, they're working with really heavy stuff. They would burn out. And then they'll be leaving. I've got to get other therapists in who may not be as well trained or as well experienced.
Sure.
And they've got to restart with those clients. So their client's recovery gets disrupted. And it becomes this vicious cycle where we're not actually helping anyone, therapist or client.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why it is so important what you're doing. And to sort of, you know, I'm so glad that we've been able to speak about that on this podcast today and to really highlight the importance of looking after yourself. We know when you're, when you are working as a therapist or a healthcare professional in eating disorders. And to kind of finish us off, I do, I feel like we have, you know, and we've spoken about the realities of working as an eating disorders therapist. And I think that's really important. However, there is a reason that you're still doing it, I hope. And I know that when we spoke initially, I think I said something to you, and if you don't want me to mention this podcast, I can delete it. I said something to you about crying, and you were like, oh, I've had a great day because a patient cried. And I was like, oh, wow, that's, you know, that's a bit harsh. And you're like, but that means that I've broken through. And that means that I'm like helping this person and helping them achieve something. So why is it that you stay in the work that you do?
I have a memory from when I was sort of 5 or 6. I was walking through the city where I grew up with my mum, and I've got no idea who this person was, but I saw a lady sat on some steps outside the building crying. And I was, at that moment, I knew I didn't like that. I knew I didn't like seeing people upset. And that has stayed with me to now. I'm 36 now, and it's still with me. So when clients are coming in, yes, it's really heavy work. And some sessions you leave and it feels like you've gone 12 rounds of Mike Tyson. But then you get those sessions where something shifts and you see a genuine smile or you see a genuine bit of confidence. And that is the best feeling in the world. And if you don't mind, I've got 2 examples I'm allowed to give you for the podcast. I've checked out the clients I'm allowed to give you. Example one was a client who had to rearrange their appointment and messaged me to say that the day of the new appointment was their 2-year anniversary of recovery. Unbeknownst to me and them, so I went and bought a cupcake for them to celebrate that. And I then had no idea they had also bought cupcakes to bring in for the session. And cupcakes were their last fear food challenge. And they did it in a session with me. You know, they had a cupcake. I had a cupcake. That was flipping brilliant. I loved that. And then the other example, this one's a little bit longer ago now, but a client who was being... was at university on a medical type degree and kept getting told, no, you can't come back for third year. You can't come back for third year. You're not ready. You're not healthy enough. And she got the phone call saying, you can come back. And, oh, I literally jumped and shouted and screamed because that was just incredible. You know, that's someone, she wasn't better, but it wasn't recovered by that point, but she was recovered enough that she could go back and pursue what she wanted to be pursuing.
Yeah.
That's why we stick this out.
And I think you used a word earlier, you used the word resilient. And I think from my experience of working with eating disorder healthcare professionals, resilience is the key word because you have the resilience to, you know, sit in a session with a patient, with a client, and then absolutely hate you and, you know, probably say really bad things about you when they leave. They might even say them to your face, but you hold on to that resilience. You go through that with them. You go through the impact that it has on you. And then after however long, sometimes it can take frigging ages. And so that patience as well, you then see that person become themselves and recover from their eating disorder. And like you said, that, you know, that takes potentially a long time, but to be able to see that transition. And I think that's what I was saying earlier about normally in healthcare, you probably see somebody get well quite quickly. It might be that they've, I don't know, broken their arm, and then you put it in a cast and it fixes. That could still take a while, but you're going to see them, a couple of months later and their arm's fixed. That's not going to be the case with an eating disorder. But I think if you can withstand the time that it takes someone to recover, the reward for you as a therapist by the end of it is just like 1,000 times bigger, because it has been that much more difficult journey to get somebody there.
I completely agree. I've actually got a box over in the corner of my office. Well, I call it a box, it's a big wicker hamper, and it's full of cards and gifts I've been given at the end of someone's treatment. And if I've had a really rough day or rough week, I go into that and I read through that collection of memories of, oh yeah, this person recovered, and that gets you through. And if I can go off on 30-second tangent for a little side note very quickly, Han. You said about clients occasionally hating you. Yes, they absolutely do. Now, I know people are going to be listening to this podcast, but you might be able to see, if I turn, can you see below the door handle and to the left, there's a mark on my door? Can you see that?
No, because you've frozen.
Oh, why is it frozen? That's rubbish.
I'm going to imagine I can see this mark on the door.
It looks like a mark. It's actually a hole in my door. And it's a hole in my door from where a client got really angry with me and threw their mobile phone, because I challenged them to reduce exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep that hole there because it's just a funny reminder. I use it with clients to say, you are going to hate me, and that's okay. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. No, I really love that story, because I think ultimately, at the end of the day, the things that we do that the eating disorder hates the most are the things that are going to help us to recover the most. And if it brings that much anger up at you that you throw your phone at the wall and create a dent in it, that's provoking some emotion. And feeling emotion, I think, in recovery as well, is something that a lot of the time takes a long time to come through. So I just love the fact that you have a box of a hamper full of all cards and thank you notes, because that just shows how much you care and how much passion you put into your work. So I think if anyone takes anything from this, I think this has been an absolutely incredible conversation and a really insightful one into working as a therapist. But I think if anyone takes anything, then that Richard cares. And if you're looking, don't want to increase your waiting list like to 20,000, but if you're looking for a therapist that is going to challenge you but cares a hell of a lot about you, then I think we found one. On that note, if people are interested in finding more out about the eating disorder recovery clinic, maybe coming for you for support, where can they reach out and find you?
So we've got a website, which is edrecovery.co.uk. Just a heads up, it is being redone. So it's going to be a bit hit and miss for the next couple of months. It is being redone. And then people can also just give us a call. Our phone number is 01278-619-149. You can give us a call. Calling or messaging us does not mean that we're going to start charging you straight away. It's a massive decision, entering treatment, utterly massive.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a call, send us an email. Our email is hello@edrecovery.co.uk. Send us an email and we will just talk with you and help you make the right decision for you. Whether that's working with us, working with someone else, or not working with anyone yet, we will help you make that decision. So whatever you do for recovery, it can get off to the right step for you.
Brilliant. And I'll put those details in the show notes for people, so they don't have to go and run and grab a pen and rewind and try and write everything down. But honestly, it's been such a pleasure to chat to you. And I think, it's a stark reality, which is a sad reality, but I'm just so grateful for people and for services like yourselves that are helping people and giving them the right support. So thank you very much. And
thank you. And thank you for having me. I'll speak to you soon. Take care.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations.